Heading into our last hour, your questions for Daniel Sekulich, joining the conversation here, whether we're talking about the souls of ships, whether they're talking about the big ship graveyard, which was fascinating, and or any of the graveyard slash battlefields that Daniel has visited, or to the main subject of piracy. We can go in a bunch of different directions. We'll see which one comes up first when you jump on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. Daniel Sekulich for a variety of topics, mostly having to do with the sea. Brad is in New York on Coast to Coast AM. Brad?
Good morning, Ian.
Morning.
This is great to have Daniel on here because I always wanted to ask this question, and he would probably know this for sure. Is the international law that you cannot carry any firearms on any cargo ships or tanker ships in any port in the world?
No, Brad, no, there's actually no international law which prevents that. This is the problem of domestic laws. And, you know, it's a good question that you brought up because it raises the issue of why aren't mariners arming themselves to, you know, deter pirate attacks. And one of the problems that we run into is that many nations don't allow military or non-military vessels, merchant ships, to enter their ports, enter their waters, with weapons aboard. So, you know, a place like Singapore or Kuala Lumpur, or not Kuala Lumpur, Port Klang. They don't want to have private vessels coming into their waters with weapons. So that's the problem. Doesn't come when you're in the middle of the Indian Ocean or the middle of the South China Sea. It happens when you eventually reach the port, which is where merchant vessels end up making for and have to put up with local laws. The same thing applies in the Caribbean, for instance, if when small vessels, pleasure boaters, many of whom like to have a piece of protection aboard, when they pull into a port to, you know, have some fun or replenish or whatnot, they could face prosecution from local authorities. So it's something you have to really look into carefully before you get into it.
Well, obviously, it's probably not legal for any of these guys to be carrying RPGs with them on a boat. So, I mean, how closely are these governments really looking to see who's violating those laws? If we go within 12 miles of the coast of Somalia, for example, and we're in Somalia's waters, but the ships that are going in there with guns, is Somalia in any shape to stop them?
None whatsoever.
Right. So why are we living by those rules? If you have a merchant ship that supposedly can't bring a gun into the domestic waters of Somalia, if the Somalian government is so completely ineffectual, they can't enforce their own rules, I think we should be able to drive through there without worrying about anybody from the Somalian government boarding us.
Yeah, the problem isn't Somalian, you know, waters, because most mariners keep well away from Somalian waters. They keep well out in international waters. The worry isn't there. The legal worry comes up when you come into a regular port to pick up your cargo, whether it's in the Far East or in Europe. That's where we get constrained by laws. And this is the problem. We end up having to play by the rules where the bad guys don't. And we need to find some other ways to get around that or to at least find a more effective way.
What's wrong with this plan? Okay, so we take a ship, right? We take something that looks like the Maersk Alabama, but we load it up with cannons, with machine guns in obvious places. So let's say we put it just outside of the international waterline outside of Somalia, where there's still plenty of piracy that takes place. Correct?
Yes.
Okay, so then what happens is we just sit out there with this ship, and we wait for the other for the pirates to start showing up. And as soon as a group of pirates comes up, we just lower that little, you know, opening where the 50 cals are in, and we just rip the snot out of the boat that they're riding on. And we just keep doing that. We create a lure and then just keep luring more and more pirates to come out there, and we attack them that way. What do you think?
You know, the famous Q ships from the Second World War, the mysterious ships. This is an idea which has been floated very seriously, too, in some quarters, the idea of having some sort of several vessels out off of the Horn of Africa being able to do that. The problem we run into here is it's really hard to fathom how big a piece of territory of water these pirates are predating upon right now. Off of the coast of Somalia, they're working waters which are bigger than the entire eastern seaboard of the United States, and trying to be everywhere and anywhere just isn't working. And here, I'll give you an example. There are over 20 naval vessels primarily clustered in the northern part near the approaches to the Gulf of Aden, and they are doing escort duties, they are interdicting, they are on patrol, and they haven't been able to contain piracy. I mean, it's up since they have arrived in greater numbers this year than it was in any year in the past. If we can't do it in that one area, how are we going to do it in an even broader area?
Okay. All right. Well, I'm still holding out for my two ideas. Privateering, letters of marque back again, and then these decoy ships where you bring them on in, and then they find out when it's too late, oh, we thought we were going to rob you, and you turn out to be the Death Star out there. George is hanging on in Altoona, Pennsylvania, for Daniel Sekulich. Go ahead, George.
This morning, something similar to what you were just suggesting, but instead of one large ship, what about reinstating like the old PT boats like they did in the Pacific during World War II, a small fleet of fast attack boats, heavily armed, with a small amount of troops, either U.S. or U.N., but they're the same size as what the Somalis use, and the PT boats covered most of the Pacific Ocean during the war against Japan. Could something like that be used against the pirates?
And believe it or not, George, we've already got, there's already small fast attack craft in those waters. There's not just the big frigates that are out there. Well, there are patrol boats, which are deliberately out there for that purpose, as well as the helicopters operating from naval vessels, and even fixed-wing aircraft, which are out there on patrol, keeping an eye out for pirates. This is you know, we're throwing a lot of firepower at this, and they're still getting around us.
You know, I'm thinking about how badly dressed these pirates are and how shabby those ships are. And it just wouldn't seem hard to get a crew, say, if we're talking about Somalis. There are any number of Somali Americans not far from where I live. They're a huge population influx in Minnesota. So let's recruit some Somali Americans that are willing to fight for their new country. That wouldn't be hard. Many of them go into the armed forces as it is. And then we get them dressed up as terribly as those pirates are, and we stick them on those same ships so that when they're out in the middle of the ocean, they look like regular pirates. And then they could even lure the other pirates to come with them. But the good Somalis are going to be bringing the pirate Somalis out to a steel trap that's waiting for them out in the ocean.
That's one of the, you know, that is, Ian, one of the most unique ideas I've actually heard in quite some time. And okay. I haven't heard that idea floated before.
All right. Well, you know, I won out of three then. I'm doing okay. Let's get first-time caller line. Brian is in Longview, Texas on Coast to Coast AM for Daniel Sekulich, Terror on the Seas, True Tales of Modern Day Pirates. And then that book before this, which was called Ocean Titans, was it?
Yes.
Okay. About the souls of ships. Hey, Brian, go ahead.
Oh, yes, sir. I mainly wanted to ask about the, he was speaking briefly about the battlefields earlier, and I'm retired military, and I find that interesting. I just wanted to know what battlefield that he came across that he found interesting overall, or he found all of them interesting.
Brian, I certainly found the First World War battlefield particularly fascinating because I was taken to areas the general public doesn't see, which are, they're roped off for obvious purposes because they're strewn with unexploded ordnance. And to actually wander through the remnants of trenches, to come across barbed wire that was still lying on the ground was, you know, a bit of a shock to me because those are just grainy black and white films that I've seen on, you know, the History Channel late at night type of thing.
Right.
One of the things that I will always remember was being taken into the special area that the French teams used to secure the ordnance that they captured, that they have unearthed. and being shown the stockpiles of chemical weapons, mustard gas, phosgene gas, chlorine gas. And one of them, when the shells get rusted, what they will do is take the liquid out, put them into plastic jerry cans until they can figure out how to dispose of them. And one of the Frenchmen took me over, and he unscrewed the top of the cap, and he said, "You can have a smile. Don't get too close." And I've been told that this was phosgene gas. And I've been told this beforehand, and it's true. Phosgene gas smells like a fresh-cut lawn. And the thing that struck me and will stay with me is that at that moment I smelled 1916, and it was a very, very powerful thing. So that, I think that France is one of the places that will always stick with me.
Mike is in Colorado Springs for Daniel Sekulich, who's a TV filmmaker and documentarian as well as an author. Go ahead, Mike.
Good evening, Ian and Daniel. This has certainly been one of the better programs I've heard on Coast to Coast, and I'm a regular listener. And Daniel, I was wondering, first of all, if you're a Canadian, your pronunciation of out.
That's given away, hasn't it?
Project.
Yes, I was a graduate of two Canadian universities, and I got used to listening to it when I was at McGill and at the University of Toronto. I read Harrison E. Salisbury's 900 Days as a child, and it made quite an impression on me. And, you know, Ted Turner made that documentary about the Forgotten War. Most Americans don't know much about what happened in the Soviet Union. As a Canadian, you probably were treated perhaps differently and maybe had some access in the Soviet Union that some Americans may or may not have. I don't know. But you touched on something I had never heard before, which was that German and Austrian veterans groups were, I guess, paying third-party individuals to go and unearth remains at these battlefields, which must be absolutely immense, the area we're talking about. Do the Russians allow this freely? They aren't concerned about, because I understand that some of these, and certainly in some countries, these hallowed grounds, people aren't allowed to trample all over. Talk more about that, if you could.
That's a really good question, Mike, because one of the things that was kind of found odd when I was in Russia was the fact that Valery Strykov, this man who was hired by German and Austrian veterans groups, was being hired by, if you will, the old enemy. And they were paying him, and the local government, it was allowed. He was permitted to do this, because unlike the grave robbers, and there are those who go out and they try and dig into old bunkers and get the medals and, you know, sell them on the internet, he wasn't doing this. He was taking the bodies, and they would then be reinterred in a German military cemetery that's outside of Volgograd. And the thing that I remember I was saying to him one day, you know, what about the Russians? I mean, how come they're not digging this stuff up? And he started to talk to me about the sort of lack of understanding about their history and the level of, they just don't understand, you know, what a life is worth.
And the next, life is cheaper in Russia?
Well, sort of. And here's what happened. 2 days after this, I was getting ready to leave my hotel, and I heard a muffled boom from somewhere. And when my driver picked me up and we were heading out to the steps to go film some more work going on out there, we passed by a Russian military camp in the city, and there was police and soldiers everywhere. And I asked what was going on, and I was told that a bunch of recruits had, in a typical Russian manner, they split the base into two with a street going down the middle. And a bunch of recruits were marching from where their barracks were across the street to where the mess hall was for breakfast. Somebody had planted a bomb in a tree, and it went off, and it killed about a dozen of these recruits. I was completely shocked by this. I mean, I expected the city to be in lockdown mode.
Right.
Because this would, you know, I said, if this happened in North America, you wouldn't be able to move.
Right,
and of course,
right.
Everyone was saying at the time, oh, it's probably Chechen rebels. No one ever proved it. But by the end of the day, when we returned back to the city, we drove by, and all there was, all I saw on the same site where these young recruits had died was a few wreaths and one military policeman standing there looking somewhat bored. And that's when I realized what this guy was talking about. There was just a sense of whatever that went on. And it's unfortunate, but you know, the Germans and the Austrians were more interested in finding their dead comrades than the Russians were.
Well, and you look at the numbers that the Tsar sent to fight in World War I, and it was staggering. The millions of people who would die, or for that matter, the 1 million people that might die in a major battle. I mean, it just sort of seems our losses historically in this country are so small compared to the history of Russian battle losses.
Yeah, and you know, just a few years before I came to Russia to do the filming, I'd been told that at an attempted meeting between Russian and German veterans, it didn't go well. It turned into a shouting match and whatnot. When I was there, I guess something had happened. Maybe they'd gotten a little bit older, whatever. And I was allowed to attend a dinner where the Russians and the German veterans all sat down together. And I will tell you, it was one of the most moving things I've ever seen because, you know, a few decades earlier, these people were trying to kill each other in one of the most brutal battles where cannon fodder was not just some sort of myth or stereotype.
Right, right, an expression, right. Yeah. All they were doing was just putting bodies in front of cannons.
Right.
In the classic case of as the story goes, that the Russian captains would shoot any of the Russian army that turned to run away from the invading Germans. So they would have to stand there and die either at the hands of the Germans or be shot in the back by their own commanders who had the machine guns trained on them.
Yeah.
Just to show you how much of human cannon fodder they were. All right, so Casper in Portland, Oregon, on a wild card line on Coast to Coast AM for Daniel Sekulich, Terror on the Seas. Casper?
Thank you for your perspective on the European battlefronts. I've been to actually most of the major Pacific World War battlefronts.
Oh, really?
Yeah, Saipan, Tinian, Okinawa.
Wow.
My father's been to Iwo Jima. The thing that struck me most, particularly about Saipan. Saipan was a Japanese protectorate for 20 years after World War I, before we liberated it in 1944. And just the sheer amount of ordnance still there.
At Okinawa?
Actually, in Saipan. Okinawa is pretty much picked over. It's clean because it's very industrialized. If you can get into the caves in Okinawa, that is a very, very illuminating place. Just the sheer massive amount of preparation and manpower it took to dig that out, literally. But the thing that strikes me most is a few years back, about 10 years back, I went there for Christmas as a present. And in one of the caves, I actually found remains. Oh, and the Imperial Japanese soldier or sailor, you couldn't really tell which. And the basic attitude of the Japanese government is it's done, it's over with. Their policy was once they found out someone had died, they had a burial. And they put whatever personal item in a place called Yasukuni Shrine.
Like a pen, you know, a shoe, anything they had from that person, not necessarily remains, right?
Yeah.
And so once that was done, then it was sealed. They didn't care about the body.
Correct. And it's actually been up to us since the end of the war, the Joint POW-MIA Command, which I believe is the largest identifier using DNA in the world.
Huh.
It's based in Pearl Harbor.
Well, that's about all I have time for on that. But thank you so much, Casper. That's very interesting. And that's God's work you're doing, as far as I'm concerned. Keep that up. Last half hour, Daniel Sekulich, Terror on the Seas, True Tales of Modern Day Pirates. And as you're hearing, so much more. Great questions. Terrific comments. Let's get 30 more minutes of that next on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. All right, last half hour, love these calls we're getting, and most importantly, I like how Daniel is answering them, too. Here's a guy who's traveled around the world a little bit, doing some very interesting work for the History Channel and some other places as a TV documentarian and an author. And the new book, was started at a time when he was fighting to get publishers to get interested in piracy. They were saying, oh, it's on the way down. Nobody really cares. And here his book was sitting right in the pipeline just as the Maersk Alabama was taken hostage. Thank God that it ended the way that it did, with as few casualties as possible. I know several of the pirates were killed, but it's going to take a lot more than that to stop piracy. You can jump in on that or any of these other conversations we're having at the same time with Daniel on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Ponet. You know, I don't think I'll forget Daniel's description about walking across a battlefield in Russia and just looking down and seeing all the scattered human remains that were there, what, 60-some-odd years later. That's going to stay with me for a while. Sandra is in New Mexico, first-time caller line for Daniel Sekulich on Coast to Coast AM. Sandra?
Yes, good morning, gentlemen. I wanted to ask, did there ever at any point in the history of pirates exist a pirate code?
That's a really good question, Sandra, and I'm a dope that I didn't think of that. That's excellent. Daniel?
You mean like a pirate haven, so to speak?
Yeah, well, or like any kind of like established, codified, a good pirate does this, a pirate won't do that, sort of the pirate laws, if you will.
No, there are places like Nassau in the Bahamas and Jamaica where pirates basically ruled the roost type of thing. But there is a famous myth that went around several hundred years ago that Madagascar had turned into a pirate republic. Libertalia is what they called it. And back in Europe, they worried that this was a place where pirates had their own laws. They lived outside of the constraints of, you know, Western rule, supposedly even had their own language. There was no slavery. It was all a myth. It never existed. But I think the closest you can come to it today definitely is Somalia. You have ports like Ayel on the coast there that are effectively pirate havens. Yeah, I mean, pirates work there. They run there. They influence the economy.
But do they have pirate rules that they agree to and then live by? Where if you violated the rules, even the pirate rules, you might have to, you know, I know they didn't really, but walk the plank kind of a thing if you violated the pirate rules.
There are still, surprisingly, rules of conduct for pirates operating today. In Somalia, for instance, pirates who go aboard a ship, the first person who boards a ship that is successfully captured gets a greater cut of the share of the ransom. Pirates who might steal from one another or even at times steal from the crew that they're holding hostage, they can be sent ashore and they'll never get a single dollar that comes in ransoms. And certainly one of the codes in Somalia is to try and make sure you don't harm the hostages too much, because they are the most valuable bargaining chip that you have in trying to negotiate these ransoms.
Sure.
Run into the millions.
So there are modern codes of conduct for pirates. Were there back in the days of Captain Morgan and others where they lived by certain rules in the ship?
Yeah, and one of the really interesting things is these were really an early form of an employment or a labor contract, and then existed hundreds of years ago at a time when this was, nobody else would have even thought about this. And, I mean, it was a very simple idea. A bunch of criminals are going to go on account, as they called it, and take to pirating. So they set out a series of rules that whoever gets, the shares that will be cut from whatever ransoms or whatever booty is got. If you're injured, you lose an arm, you lose a hand, you lose a leg, you get a certain amount in compensation. And rules of conduct between one another, not to gamble, not to steal.
Right.
So, yeah, they did exist, and it was a very, very interesting, as I said, an early form of a labor contract, and it predated anything that any union ever thought of years, by centuries.
I'm going to get to some other questions, but I'm curious about this. What about their treatment of women? Was there a code of conduct where they were expected, for example, as pirates, not to be rapists?
Mm-hmm. Yes. The treatment of women was also something that was, for the most part, taken relatively seriously. And the reason for that was actually quite simple. They didn't want a bunch of guys fighting over one woman prisoner.
Right.
It could break down the discipline that they needed to maintain their operations.
So it was understood up front, nobody got it.
Exactly.
Nobody got, okay, nobody got to have, okay, good. I'm so glad. That's so interesting. Thank you. Tanisha is in San Antonio, east of the Rockies on Coast to Coast AM. Tanisha?
Yes, hello?
Am I pronouncing that right?
Tanisha?
Tanisha. Okay, thank you.
Yes. Yes, I had a question. I don't know if you mentioned this on the show. I didn't listen to the whole thing, but about the connection between the toxic waste dumping by European countries off the Somali coast and the piracy there.
Okay, that's a great question. Daniel?
Yeah, that's, Tanisha, the dumping of waste and illegal fishing has been going on off the coast of Somalia for almost 20 years. It's actually nothing new. And it was one of the reasons back in the 90s why some of the Somali fishermen became angry about the situation and ended up taking up arms and attacking fishing boats and then moving on to larger targets as they realized they could make some money. But I'd like to point out one thing. That there has been some talk in media lately that this is a valid justification for what the Somali pirates are doing, that somehow they are eco-warriors trying to correct a wrong that's been going on by foreigners and in attacking foreign vessels in return. And I just don't buy that at all, because it doesn't justify attacking, for instance, aid ships carrying United Nations food aid for their own people.
Right.
One, you know, that just doesn't cut it with me. And
one of the guys you interviewed in the book was, he was on one of those aid ships, and he was held captive for 100 days, and it ruined his life. And all he was trying to do was bring rice into the Somali people.
Well, and this is exactly the situation which happened with the Maersk Alabama. It was under contract to the United Nations to bring aid to the people in Africa. Don't try to tell me that something that happened a decade and a half ago justifies those actions today.
Tanisha, are you okay with that, Tanisha?
I haven't, really looked into it. I just heard about it and did a little research, and I heard that when the tsunami hit, I don't know, in, 2004, 2005 or whatever, that a whole bunch of the cans were opened up with toxic waste. And,
oh, that's interesting.
Some of the people in Somalia were getting sick.
Oh, that's very interesting. Had you heard about that with the tsunami opening up the cans?
Yeah,
Daniel?
It affected people ashore in Somalia. They got sick, and it was chronicled by the United Nations and other organizations. But again, you know, you see toxic waste dumping and illegal fishing going on. It's not just Somalia. It goes on all over the world, unfortunately.
Right.
But you don't see, for instance, off of the western tip of Africa where this happens, you don't see people there turning to piracy as a means of or dealing with that situation or overcoming it somehow. It's only where you get a breakdown of law and order and people can do whatever they want. So
Jason, can you tell me who's on west of the Rockies? Mike, it's just not up on my screen for whatever reason. Mike, Long Beach, California on Coast to Coast. Mike?
Yeah, hi. I just wondered if Daniel was, at the beginning, you mentioned the Queen Mary was dead, sort of. There are souls, though, reported on the Queen Mary. As a matter of fact, it's one of the most active paranormal sites in the world, according to the Google I just searched. So I'm real familiar with all the ghost stories. I think George has been down here studying.
Yeah, I know he has. That's interesting in contrast to that, the ship may be soulless in the way that some, you know, that it's full of ghosts is what you're saying, which is also
sure, that's a different
cool
type
yeah
of thing.
Oh, that's very cool. No, yeah. Daniel, what do you think of that?
You're absolutely correct. There's a difference between the ship's soul and those of people who had been aboard it. And I remember being in Lang, India, aboard a supertanker that had been cut up. It was an American one. It had been operated by Amoco, going from Alaska down to California, carrying crude from the North Slope. And I encountered a letter that had been written by a crew member, unsigned, unsent, unfinished. And reading it, I was struck that there was an element of that person that was still there.
Mm. They also, of course, filmed part of the Poseidon Adventure on the Queen Mary. At the beginning of the Poseidon Adventure, when before they go into the, you know, the scenes where the ship turns over and stuff, all of the exterior shots of the things that happened on the deck happen on the deck of the Queen Mary. And I'm fascinated by it. I love the Poseidon Adventure. I know everything about the Poseidon Adventure, and it's something I keep intending to do. So next time I get to L.A., that's definitely where I'm headed. Thanks, Mike. Is it Karen?
Yes, it is Karen. Good
evening. Okay, Karen.
Good morning, actually, gentlemen.
And to you.
Hello?
Hi, yes, and to you. Here's.
Well, I'm a long-time listener, I would say over 15 years by now. And I always, many times I would like to call with a comment or question because program is absolutely fabulous. Everybody loves it, and we do have the right to say these words. But today, sorry to use this word, I was kind of disgusted with your guest's view of Russian people in Stalingrad's war. The way he disregarded the Russian souls who is there.
Wait. I don't know how did he disregard the Russian souls?
Well, when he said the Germans and Austrians are more caring about their comrades than Russians do, something like that.
Well, hang on. Let's establish what he said first. Okay, go ahead, Daniel. I think Karen misunderstood you there, but go ahead.
No, and Karen, I know what you're saying. It sounds cold. It sounds impersonal. It sounds somewhat distant. But unfortunately, when I was there, the reality was that there was no effort by either the Oblast government or the national government to do anything about finding, disinterring, and giving a proper burial to those members of the Red Army who had fought in that battle.
Well, it's terrible. Is that what you saw? And if it's true, it's absolutely terrible. I agree with you. I am from Russia. But to my knowledge, there is a group of people who is disinterring the remains, they establishing the names as possible. And I watch that on the Russian TV here in America all the time. If those groups, you were not surrounded with those groups or you didn't meet them at the time you've been traveling, it does not mean Russia doesn't do anything for it. Just try to compare two numbers. 800,000 approximate numbers, of course, what the United States unfortunately lost in the Second World War. And if you're ready for this,
right?
27
yeah.
million Russians lost.
Well, I think, and you may not have heard, I was actually making that point, that there's a staggering number of people, even under the Tsar in World War One, the number of people he would send off to die.
That's how Russians fight. If they fight, the whole country fights.
Yeah,
but not a question, not about the Tsar. We're talking about Second World War, which was under rule of tyranny of Joseph Stalin.
Right.
And to knowledge and of a professional people today, as the history goes and they do their researches, they understand the numbers will be much, much less if country will be ready for the war.
Right. No, I get that. I appreciate your comment. I hope you feel like we rebalanced things a little bit for you. But I'll say again, I think anytime you're talking about, as you said, 27 million people lost, there's a certain point where that number just must get so overwhelming. I don't even know that you can begin to go and make a national effort to find a grave for every one of those people. I mean, that's just like I sort of relate to the idea of kind of just walking away from a battlefield that big and just going, oh my God, there's so many people out there. What do you do except just kind of try to move forward? But I appreciate your point. I hope that you feel like you've been heard. And Carol is in Westchester, New York, on Coast to Coast AM. Carol?
Yes, good morning, Mr. Sekulich, Mr. Bonnet. Thank you for taking my call. I haven't heard this mentioned ever anywhere, and I'd like to put this question to you regarding piracy on the seas. As soon as a commercial liner or any other kind of vessel knows they're being targeted by a pirate ship and signals to the land or to their country or to their army, why can't that pirate ship be taken out from the air? That's what I would like to know. Assuming that there's no hostages on it.
Sure. You mean like an Air Force strike?
Ever heard that mentioned, ever.
Yeah, I think that may have to do with how far away some of these ships are, even when they're under attack. But Daniel, interesting point. Why not be able to call the Air Force and say the pirates are coming and be able to get a jet fighter over to take them out?
Yeah, well, you're right, Ian, about the time that goes between a Mayday first coming in, the ability to respond to that and ability to dispatch like a fixed-wing aircraft from a base somewhere. By the time they get there, you know, you could be talking about an hour could have gone by. Even dispatching a helicopter from a vessel, which was, you know, perhaps maybe the helicopter is 15 minutes away. Pirates, it's commonly believed, have about a 15-minute window of opportunity. Once they get aboard a ship, they will either capture it or they'll have to retreat within about 15 minutes. That's not a huge window there. And
right.
You know, there, one of the theories put forward too, another potential is to add in, you know, more air cover over the region with tankers to refuel them on a constant patrol.
Right.
But you're also getting at something here too, which is there aren't that many nations in the world which have the military capabilities to do all of this.
Right.
The United States certainly does, but I don't think it's the United States' sole responsibility to deal with piracy, whether it's off of the Horn of Africa or anywhere else.
Well, that brings me back to my theory about having privateers and letters of marque. I wonder whether other countries that don't have the resources that we have, they might just resort to that. And they just say, look, it almost sounds like something one of the Arab countries would do, and just merely say, look, you go deal with the pirates. If you come across a pirate, you have been given prevenient grace on whatever it is that you're going to do with those pirates. If you found a true pirate, I just almost expect that sort of thing is going to start to develop. But let's go. What I think we have time for? No, we don't. Okay, we're out of time. But thank you, everybody. Really good questions, and I'm so grateful too for the thoughtful way that people are talking about battlefields, which, you know, I love, Daniel. I will pull over if I'm driving down the road and I come across a battlefield, Civil War battlefield, Revolutionary War battlefield. I'll pull over all the time just to stand there and sort of take in the moment and sort of just take in the look and feel of it. And I actually sort of resent, I know this is probably wrong, but I resent a lot of the battlefield reenactors who do these. I know they're very sincere and they really want to get it right, but there's just no way to ever really tell the story of the horror of these battlefields with, when you're using, you know, a 20th of the number of people who are out on that field dying that day. And I think what you talked about when you talked about the bones and Verdun and some of these other, I think that paints a much more vivid picture in my mind than even watching somebody do a battlefield reenactment.
And you know what, Ian, I think that you're absolutely correct. In my opinion as well, the only way that you can appreciate a battle from hundreds of years ago, the First World War, the Second World War, or even like the ongoing battle against pirates, is personally, and that is to take that moment you talked about and to actually just think about it and to try to make your own impression about it. Without that, as I said, you know, it's like a cultural amnesia. It's a bunch of guys dressed up doing something, whatever.
Right. Well, thank you so much. And again, Daniel's other book was Ocean Titans. That's where he went in search of the soul of ships and going all the way down to seeing them break apart. I hope you get great action on both of these books on Amazon tonight or in your local bookstore. Terror on the Seas is the new one, True Tales of Modern Day Pirates. And thank you so much. Hope you have a great summer. Coming up soon, I think in the next week or so, there's a new book out about the search of Bigfoot, which we'll get to. And I was reading that earlier in the week, and it's terrific. And Spymaster is a new book out about the Cold War and one particular spy for Russia who spied on Americans. So perhaps Karen, who was listening earlier, will be able to call back in on that topic, too. Very interesting. Tomorrow's a big day for me. Last day of my old call. So I'm going to scoot out of here and go work on my sermon. Deus te amat. And I do, too.